Now it's time for the water and the fitness of the environment chapter, the one that addresses all of these special properties of water that I was talking about earlier. And in the opening slide, we can see water molecules again with forming hydrogen bonds between them, just like the hydrogen bond we looked at originally was forming between water and ammonia. It doesn't matter whether it's what the specific molecules are, as long as they're polar, they will form hydrogen bonds. And you almost never, effectively never, have a single water molecule. Usually you have trillions and trillions of them, even in a tiny droplet. So there's multiple water molecules, not just one. And there's three different poles, really, right? There's two partially positive poles, the two hydrogens, and one partially negative pole, the oxygen end. And in it, when you therefore have a population of water molecules and they get close to each other, they will swivel, like I said, so that the partially positive end will be next to the partially negative end of the other. And this gives a population of water molecules a little bit more ordered structure than a more chaotic population of nonpolar molecules like oxygen would have. They would just be not caring what the others are doing, not affected by the presence of the others, except when they bounce off of each other. All right? And that gives water all kinds of special properties, which is what most of the rest of the chapter is devoted to. Starting with slide 2, in which we see a plant, this tree, and the movement of water through its body. The movement of water through a plant is a one-way movement. You can see it depicted by the direction of the blue arrows. Water enters a plant, and we're assuming this is a vascular plant, which almost all living plants nowadays are, meaning plants with vessels in them. But water enters through the root system and then moves up through the body of the plant and then exits or leaves through the leaves continuously. That whole continuous process is called transpiration. So plants transpire water. And the fact that they're, well, I'll talk about that later. Anyway, this absolutely necessary to keep the plant alive because all parts of the body of the plant need liquid water, just like we do. Well, notice that this is because of the way plants live a vertical life. Notice that this is a movement of water in exactly the opposite direction from what it wants to travel in, right? Which is downhill. Water wants to fall, because its gravity doesn't stop for the sake of the plants getting water to the top. The water has to travel against gravity to rise through the plant, to transpire. And that takes a lot of energy. Well, we're looking at a very close-up view on the right here of just some water molecules inside one tiny straw-like vessel. The vessels in these plants are called xylem vessels. That's not important that you know that name, but anyway, this is one xylem of millions that are in the tree. They're like little straws, or like little capillary tubes. Now, if you know what I mean by glass capillary tubes in a lab? If you put a glass capillary tube onto a drop of blood, it seems like it sucks the blood right up against gravity, right? It rises in the tube against gravity. That's called capillary attraction, and that's what's happening here as well, only with water instead of blood. Blood is mostly water, by the way, which is why it works for blood. But this is all because of hydrogen bonding, and that wouldn't happen if water were not a polar molecule. So there are two labeled forces here, forces of attraction, even though they really are the same thing. They're both hydrogen bonding, but we give them different names depending on what's involved. So we have adhesive forces and cohesive forces, or adhesion and cohesion. Cohesion is force of attraction between two particles that are the same, two like particles. whereas adhesion is force of attraction between different type particles. But it's hydrogen bonding in both cases here. So you have cohesion existing as the hydrogen bonds between subsequent water molecules. They're all the same, so it's cohesion, right? You also, though, have water molecules being attracted upward to the wall of the xylem because the wall is made out of polar molecules as well. They're different from the water, though, so that's adhesive rather than cohesive. And therefore, you can imagine you can only see four members here. There's quadrillions of water molecules. You see four here that are more or less hitched to each other because of these hydrogen bonds. In other words, it's like a train of water molecules. You know, in a train, the engine is providing the force, the first car, assuming it's one engine, and then the rest of the cars are just being pulled, right? But it works because they're all hitched. And it works only if they are all hitched, of course, right? Because none of the other cars is powered. It's just being drug. That means, though, that since this is acting like a train, if the top water molecules are moving upward, then they will drag the ones below them along for the ride because of hydrogen bonding. And why would they move upward? Well, because of the evaporation that's occurring from the leaves, that's removing water, leaving spaces for them, the top ones, to move up farther by adhesive forces, and then pulling by cohesive forces all the lower ones up a little bit more. Well, if you think of the train analogy, if one of those hitches breaks, then that means you're going to leave behind a certain number of cars that aren't going to be able to move anymore, right? And the rest of the train goes onward. You form a gap. And that could happen in the tree as well, which would eventually kill it if it happens in enough vessels. So you have to maintain all of those hitches for this water to continuously be able to rise up through the plant. And it's a huge amount of force, actually, to get water to rise against gravity. Each individual hydrogen bond is tiny in magnitude, but there's a hell of a lot of them in this train, and that allows for it to happen. To get you an appreciation of how much energy it requires, or at least to just give you an analogy or a way to think about it, consider your taps in your house, which you're accustomed to delivering water when you turn on the taps, right? When you turn the spigot, you're used to the water coming out. Now, but why is that? You might never have stopped to think about it. Well, the water comes out because there is a pressure gradient. There's higher pressure inside than outside. So when you allow it by giving it an opening, water will come out. But why is there pressure to begin with? What causes the pressure in the water system? You just take it for granted by paying your bill that it's going to work. Well, what causes pressure is gravity. It's because most of the water is well above your house. Now, if you go to a plain state where there aren't mountains or hills, you'll see water towers every so often, which are big tanks of water that are taller than most buildings. And so the water is coming through pipes to your house from a place that's higher. And when you open up the spigot, it's simply falling down by gravity. It's gravity causes the pressure. Around here, we put the water tanks on mesas. We don't have to build the towers. You can see the tanks on mesas around town. But what if you build a tall building that's taller than the water towers? Well, then you're going to have to supply the energy. Because if you build a tall building and you open up a tap up there and the water tank's down here, the water's only going to go as high as the tank is. Right? Therefore, skyscrapers or any tall building need dedicated pumps powered by electricity to force that water up to the top. And that is a lot of force required. It's a lot of energy that you have to put into lifting water uphill in a high building. Well, this transpiration is not working by any electrical pumps or any mechanical pumps like a heart. It's happened just by hydrogen bonding between water molecules. And if you think about this happening in the largest plants, sequoia trees are not just the largest plants, they are the tallest organisms that have ever existed. And depending on how you define an individual organism, they are the biggest organisms that have ever existed. Bigger than blue whales, which are bigger themselves than any dinosaur. They are huge, but they're also vertically very tall. And so the taller you get this water column, the more you're fighting gravity, right? Gravity is pulling down the more and more the longer you make the train. And eventually, if you make it too long, gravity will win out and break those hitches, which would kill the tree. So it's probable that sequoias have evolved to be just about as tall as anything could be and still get water up to the top by this mechanism. Yeah.
So going back to the adhesion and all that.
Yeah.
So what is the engine? Can you remind what the engine is to that's bringing it up?
The water is being removed at the top because it's evaporating into the air at the leaves. And this is leaving spaces in there. So in this, if this isn't here, then this one will be attracted upward because of adhesive hydrogen bonding between it and the wall. And then it will pull the one below it along for the ride and so on down the line. Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to 3. This is an animal walking on water, which you can try, but I can tell you won't succeed. You'll sink, right? And this animal would sink too if it weren't for the fact that water is polar. Now, when you look at the footprints here, you can see that the surface of the water is being indented at each foot. It kind of looks like there is a skin on the water that's a little bit thicker than water itself, or water deeper down in the body of water. Well, it doesn't just kind of seem like that. That is actually the truth. There is a thicker skin on the surface of water compared to the water below it. If you imagine a container of water, which is made up of trillions and trillions of water molecules, for the depth, not at the surface, but at the depth, each of those individual water molecules is being attracted by hydrogen bonding to water molecules around it in all directions, right? So it's more or less being pulled equally in all directions. But if you think about the ones at the surface, they are being pulled downward because there's water molecules below them, but they're not being pulled upward because there aren't water molecules above them. So that compresses the top layer of so many molecules' thickness, and it makes it a more dense layer than the rest of the water. Still liquid, but it's whichever ones are there at the moment are making it just like a thicker skin. And therefore, the insect does not penetrate that thickness and is able to walk on it. Now, even though it is just like a skin, of course, it's continuously changing. The water molecules aren't there permanently. They're all moving around, but there's always going to be some that are at the surface and being members of this thicker skin. In 4, the location here does not matter at all. This is just an example. But we have a large body of water abutting a large landmass. And I use this map to give you a couple different definitions more, one of which is specific heat capacity. Now, any given substance has some value for what we call the specific heat capacity. Depends on the substance as to what the value is. But the specific heat capacity is defined as the amount of energy required to raise the temperature of 1 gram of that substance by 1 Kelvin or by 1 degree centigrade. They're exactly the same size, remember, those units. And the higher the value, the more energy, therefore, it requires to raise the temperature of 1 gram of that stuff. So when you compare specific heat capacities among different kinds of substances, that means they're not, since they have different values, they're not all equally easy to heat. Things with high specific heat capacities require more energy to raise the temperature of the same amount compared to another substance. And this is actually the scientific explanation for the old adage that a watched pot never boils, which of course is untrue. You give it enough time, it will boil. But it seems like it takes forever when you're waiting on it. And that's because water has a, compared to most substances, pretty high specific heat capacity. Therefore, you know, it's not going to boil till you raise the temperature a certain amount. But raising the temperature of something with a high specific heat capacity, by definition, requires more energy. You know, if you're cooking, you can get oil to heat up a lot faster, given the same pan and same heat, as you can the same amount of water. It has a much higher specific heat capacity. Oil is a nonpolar substance. Water is polar. And all of these special properties of water that we're going through here are all based on the fact that water is polar. If you imagine, well, think about what temperature is. What did I tell you temperature tells you? What is temperature? When we had the marathon lecture about scientific fundamentals, what did I say was temperature? Yeah.
The average speed.
That's right. Temperature is an indication of the average speed of the particles of whatever sample you're measuring. It's made of particles, like water. A sample of water is water molecules. Each of them is traveling at its own speed and direction, but it has a certain speed individually, and you can therefore imagine measuring them all individually and then dividing by however many there are to compute an average speed. That's the temperature. So to raise the temperature means you have to increase the average, which means you're going to have to increase the speed of individual particles, make them move faster. You do that by delivering energy to them to speed them up. But if it's a polar substance like water, then some of that energy you're trying to deliver to make them go faster is going to have to be used simply to break the hydrogen bonds between them before they can start moving faster. And therefore, it's more expensive energetically to heat something up that is polar versus nonpolar. Is that clear? And water has a pretty high specific heat capacity. Now, the biological significance of this, speaking of large bodies of water and large land masses, is that the body of water, well, both the body of water and the landmass, which are both receiving the same amount of sunlight because they're right next to each other, they're both being energized the same amount each day, and they're both going to go up in temperature during the day when there is sunlight and go down at night when they're not getting that energy input. So they're both going to have an oscillation as far as their temperature is concerned, on a daily period. But the body of water isn't going to oscillate nearly as much or with as much amplitude. It's going to be a narrow difference between the day temperature and the night temperature compared to the land mass, which is going to undergo much greater amplitude in its oscillation. It's going to get hotter during the day, and it's going to get cooler during the night than the water. It's going to be less stable, in other words, the land mass. The water is going to be more stable. Now, we are terrestrial organisms, so we tend to think about ourselves and think everyone else is like ourselves. But terrestrial organisms is really a recent thing. Never lose track of the fact that life started in the oceans. And for billions of years, that was the only place life was. It's only in the last several hundred million years that life of any kind was on land. Well, the reason for that is that the ocean is much more stable. So it was much easier for the first cells to come into existence and be successful in making new cells in a more stable environment. So that's one definition. Another is latent heat of vaporization. Vaporization really is just another word for evaporation. And evaporation, by the way, is a change in state. It's not a chemical change. If it were a chemical change, then you would have different stuff at the end than you had at the beginning. Chemical reactions are chemical changes, right? You change the substance. But when something changes state, it's still the same stuff. Now, there are five states that we recognize nowadays, but really only three of them pertain to biology courses because the other two are too extreme for life. But the three states we care about here are solid, liquid, and gas state. What, by the way, makes something a gas compared to a liquid of the same stuff? What's the difference between a gas and a liquid if you have the same substance?
I believe the bonds were farther apart.
Not the bonds. The particles. The particles themselves, the molecules, for instance, are farther apart, much farther apart in a gas compared to a liquid. So water molecules are the particles for liquid water and water vapor. When water evaporates, some of those water molecules that are very close together in liquid state become very far spaced out in the gas phase. It's still water, though, still individual water molecules. And by the way, if you think about an individual water molecule, it doesn't make sense to call it gas, liquid, or solid. Those words only apply to a population of particles, right? You can't talk about the spacing of one particle. You have to have multiple particles. But that's another way of showing you that it's a physical change, not a chemical change, because it's water. The molecules are identical, whether it's gas, liquid, or solid. Okay, so the latent heat of vaporization is another thing, another measurement that any substance has a certain value for. And once again, just like for specific heat capacity, compared to most substances, water has a high value of latent heat of vaporization. But the definition of it, of latent heat of vaporization, is the amount of energy required to convert 1 gram of liquid substance of that type into gas phase. In other words, to evaporate exactly 1 gram of that stuff, the energy required for that is the latent heat of vaporization. High compared to most substances, once again, due to hydrogen bonding. And for the same reason that it's hard to heat water, because some of that energy has to go into breaking hydrogen bonds, the same is true for evaporating water. Because to evaporate, some of those members of the liquid population need to go off on their own out into the air. To do that, they need to first break hydrogen bonds. So that's what some of the energy goes into, and then some of them to speed them up enough to get them to leave. If evaporation of water occurs, then that ends up cooling the liquid water that still remains liquid. Evaporation from a liquid batch of water will cool the liquid. But it also will cool the air into which evaporation is occurring. It cools both the liquid and the air. Now, the first of these saves your life every day as a Phoenician or a Valley resident, especially this time of year. You know, we sweat to save our lives every day, which is really just a way for our body to deliver liquid water to the surface so that some of that can evaporate, cooling the liquid that's left behind and therefore cooling our body, keeping it below lethally high temperature limits. And it's not a joke. You would die easily without this. If you bike in the summer in the valley, even if it's a short trip, it'll seem fine while you are biking. You know it's hot, but you seem fine. And then if you get only a couple blocks down, or if it's just a short trip, you get off the bike and it immediately seems like you started just now sweating, and profusely. Well, you haven't. You've been sweating at that rate the whole time you were riding. It's just that greater air movement as you ride was keeping up the evaporation, so the sweat didn't build up. And that's what allowed you to survive that trip, because your body temperature didn't rise so much to kill you because of the evaporation. Now, why is it that evaporation of water cools the water that's left over as liquid? Well, we can imagine this beaker of water again for this example. If you are a member of the liquid population, you're one of the molecules in the liquid. First of all, for you to have any chance of evaporating, you need to be at the surface, because evaporation occurs from the surface, right? Where the interface between liquid and gas. Most of them are not at the surface, but everything's moving in a liquid. They're always changing places, so eventually you will be at the surface. Let's just restrict our attention, though, to the ones at the surface. Of those ones, molecules at the surface, what is true about the ones that have the best chance of escaping into the gas phase? And don't overthink it. Just
the ones at the top.
I'm saying, if you're already at the top, there's millions of them at the top, which ones of those that are just at the top have the greatest chance of getting off on their own? They're identical in structure. What's different about them? How they're moving. Which ones have the best chance of escaping? The ones that are fastest. Exactly. The ones that are fastest have the best chance of breaking their hydrogen bonds and going off into the gas phase. Okay, now keep in mind the definition of temperature. If this happens, and you have now lost the fastest ones in your population, what happens to the average speed of the ones that are left behind? It goes down, because you've gotten rid of your fastest members. So the average is now lower, and the average is the temperature. So it cools that body of water. It's very easy to demonstrate, by the way. If you take a cloth and saturate it with as hot a water as you can handle without hurting yourself, squeeze out the water, or the most of the water, you can feel that it's hot. Just flap it about 10 times in the air, and it will no longer not only be hot, it'll be cold. because of the evaporation, reducing the cooling the liquid that's left behind in the rag. And that's why it saves your life. Now, why is it that it also cools the air? Well, it is true that when you're getting rid of the fastest ones when they go off, and that reduces the average speed of the liquid population. But a lot of those ones that are escaping, even though they're faster than the liquid molecules, are still not as fast as one of the ones that are already out here in the gas phase, or a lot of the ones that are out in the gas phase. So adding those ones that are just barely escaping is bringing the average of the gas phase down also. They're faster than the liquid, but not as fast as the average in the air, and therefore the average in the air goes down. And that, by definition, will cool the air. This is exactly why evaporative coolers were invented, right? You don't see them so much anymore, but they used to be really common in the valley. Instead of an air conditioner, you'd have an evaporative cooler, which just pumps water over mats continuously, liquid water, and then blows air through it. Well, the air blowing through it evaporates water. That makes the water cool, but that's not the goal in this case. The goal is that it also cools the air, which is then pumped into your house. And it uses a hell of a lot less energy than a compressor and an air conditioner. But it does humidify your house. Okay. Slide 5. In the middle here, we have an animal living in water under a crust of ice in the cold part of the year. And this brings up another remarkable thing about water. Very unusual. Most substances, the vast majority of substances, have a solid phase that is more dense. The particles are packed together more tightly in solid than in the liquid phase. In fact, that is the difference between a solid and a liquid when you're talking about most things. It's the spacing issue again. It's not as drastic a difference in spacing it is between liquid and gas. But for the vast majority of things, the spacing becomes much closer packed in a liquid versus a gas, and then even more packed in a solid. The other difference, though, of course, is that in a liquid, despite being close to each other, the particles are still changing positions. They're sliding past each other continuously. In a solid, they're still moving, but they're vibrating in place, and they're keeping their position more or less, which is why you don't pour solids. It has a defined shape, because the particles are locked in place. So for almost all things, the solid is the densest of the three states that we're talking about, but not for water. Water is unusual in that the solid version, which we call ice, is less dense than the liquid version. And you know this from your cocktail, right? Ice floats. Or not cocktail, ice water. Don't involve any other substances. Ice cubes in water float. They don't sink. But if you get solid chunks of just about any other substance and put it in liquid of that same substance, they will sink. If that happened for water, we wouldn't be here. So this is another reason we exist, because of the special properties of water. If you think of a body of water, when seasonally the temperatures get low, the water temperature goes lower and some of it freezes. If water were like ordinary substances, that however much freezes, which the freezing would occur at the surface because that's where it's really exposed, but as soon as ice formed, since it would be like normal substance, if that were more dense, it would quickly sink. And so there would be a formation of some layer of ice on the bottom of the body of water, whether it's a lake or whatever. it would grow, you know, that thickness would depend on how cold it got. The next season, when it thaws, some of that would melt, but not all of it. So it would get thinner that year, but there would still be some ice there. And then the next year, you'd build on that. And it would thaw, but not all the way. But each year, you'd build thicker and thicker until the whole body of water would be frozen, which makes it a lot more difficult for animals and other organisms to live in it if it's a solid than a liquid. I need to stop, so I'll say a couple more words about this next time.